Welcome to Bad Patient. Malpractice Makes Perfect. I'm Robin Donovan.
And I'm Lara Bierce.
And we are two non-medical, non-experts sifting through this week's health news. So Lara, give me our four topics for this week.
They are pollution, cheese, hurt feelings, and running.
I'm glad cheese made it in this week. I was wondering, you know, are we ever going to get to cheese?
I mean, it's important to always have cheese.
I mean, no joke, my dental hygienist yesterday was from Paris and was telling me how much he liked cheese, and I was just thinking, can I point out that you're, like, a stereotype Parisian, or like, how polite do I have to be? I pointed it out, because, you know, bad patient, right?
Always and everywhere.
So before we get started with our topics, I wanted to share some listener feedback we had from Kristen in North Carolina. And Kristen wrote in to talk to us about gene expression. Do you remember that story we did where there was like, it was like words that you said as a function of gene expression and stress would change? Maybe I'm convoluting that. It was like, your word choice was essentially like a a downstream effect of this gene expression that caused us to like express feelings in different ways. So Kristen wrote in and to let us know, and this is her quote, changes in gene expression due to stress will turn on or off a specific gene's function or increase or decrease what that gene produces. So we apparently did not quite get it right. So, that's our, I think Kristen is only our second bad expert who gave us some info. So thank you, Kristen. And also I wanted to make sure I was kind of like on, I'm not going to say in complete understanding, but on the path to understanding gene expression. And I checked out this cool page from Khan Academy, which, do you know what that is? It's like one of those online education for everyone type of sites, like Coursera or whatever.
I mean, I was unaware of its existence up until this very moment.
But, you know, it's one of these, like, you know how Harvard does, like, those edX classes or, you know, it's, like, information for everyone? Mm-hmm. I was super impressed because I actually did not find the Wikipedia page on this topic, like, super understandable. But what I learned from Khan Academy was, I mean, it's pretty simple, but so if DNA is divided into these functional units called genes, and I'm more or less reading from their page, so, you know, full disclosure, these are quotes. And so genes can specify polypeptides, which are proteins and protein subunits, or functional RNA. So we won't go too far into that. But essentially, information from the gene is used to build that functional product, which could be a protein. And then the process of that is called gene expression. So there's kind of like a flow of information from DNA to RNA to the protein or whatever product is produced.
Right.
And so I guess the story that we covered was essentially saying that certain emotional psychological factors could affect the gene expression. So we kind of had it right and we kind of didn't. So thank you, Kristen, for filling us in with a little more info. If folks are interested, the Khan Academy page is seriously, it's amazing. It's cartoons, it's drawings, it's step-by-step diagrams of exactly how this works. And it's in a very, very user-friendly format. So khanacademy.org, just search for gene expression. I'm loving this resource, so yay.
Awesome.
Yeah, and if you want to be like Kristen or like our other listeners who have asked us questions or shared information, you can tweet us on Twitter at The Bad Patient. I'm not sure where else you would tweet us. And you can email us at hello@thebadpatient.com. So please share your feedback. We love answering your questions.
Okay. You ready for our first article?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Our first article comes from Huffington Post, and it is, urban air pollution negates health benefits of long walks on city streets.
So just stay home.
Yeah, so basically it's looking, a new study found The impact of dirty air on those at least 60 years or older negates a 2-hour walk of the health benefits. So it's talking about how we need to focus on providing more green space and a healthier environment for our population, essentially.
Oh, man. I mean, I guess it depends on what city you're talking about, right? Certainly my fair city could never be on this list.
Yeah, so it's took place in, I think, London.
I think they mentioned in the second paragraph Broadway in New York City or Michigan Avenue in Chicago. Oh, but you're right. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I think Chris HuffPost has an American audience.
Oh, so they were just giving
you examples of what it is.
That's kind of a strange way of doing it, though. You'd think they would put London first. Like, if the study was conducted in London, you'd think they would say, hey, this article in The Lancet found X in London, instead of in cities like New York and Chicago. Like, are we such dumb Americans that they're like, they have a big city in Europe and they're like, oh, Americans aren't going to know what this is. Just say New York City. That's their only context clue. Like, we can't understand it otherwise.
Yeah, a little bit. They expect that the study will be replicated in North American and European cities. And he also says the impact is likely to apply to other age groups, but further studies are needed on that.
So what age group was this study?
60 and over.
Oh, come on.
The purpose of the report, essentially, is calls on for stricter air quality limits, better traffic control measures, and greater access to green space.
And for some reason, this story did not feel the need to link us to the original story.
That's because it's the Huffington Post.
Oh, no, they did. It's just not obvious. They linked the text short-term exposure to traffic exhaust, and that goes to it.
There are a lot of links in this website.
I think that's part of their like SEO strategy. Okay, and also, this was not just people 60 and older. It was people 60 and older with chronic lung or heart disease.
All right.
So, it's unhealthy people. Who I think we could have already guessed that, like, they're more sensitive to any type of environmental exposure.
Hey, how many, globally, how much does outdoor air pollution cause? How many deaths a year does it cause globally?
Well, this article says 4.5 million deaths a year.
Yeah. Isn't that kind of crazy?
That seems like a lot. And how do we, like, track that? Like, how are we like, this guy's emphysema is from smog? You know? I mean, I'm sure there must be a way, but it seems like so complicated to control for all the other factors that could potentially, like, link to it. Because it's not like you get off a bus and then air pollution just swoops down and, like, cuts your head off, right? I mean, it's a kind of a slow build to death in that case.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
It would be easier to track if, you know, it's just like pollution was just a big hammer that came down and boom, and then you're done. Oh, boy.
I also like that they got political in this piece.
Did they?
Yeah. Well, first of all, they... they quoted the project leader of Greenpeace, so that's great.
Whoa. So they went all the way to one direction.
Yeah, and they noted that the Obama administration proposed strong fuel efficiency standards for vehicles to fight air pollution.
Okay.
Since Donald Trump took office, car companies have actually been lobbying and getting these standards rolled back. As long as these automakers drag their feet, the fuel standards and sustainability regulations, they're showing that they care more about their short-term financial interests than they do about the long-term benefits for public health, the planet, and even the economy.
Okay, so they just dug right in there.
Yeah.
And obviously, like, you've seen this and I haven't, but why did they go into cars? Like, did the study somehow, were cars identified as, like, a leading cause of air pollution, or
Yeah, so they're saying because they walked in the park and then they walked on a crowded street.
Okay.
Those were the two comparisons. So they're saying that the car pollution, sucking the exhaust fumes is the problem.
Okay. Because I'm kind of like, did the Huffington Post make the leap to cars on its own, or was that like something that, you know what I'm saying? Like, was that somehow relevant in the study?
Short-term exposure to traffic exhaust is the link. So I'm going to say, looking at the study, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay. So they were looking at the effects of respiratory and cardiovascular responses of walking down a busy street with high levels of pollution, which I think we can kind of assume a busy street with high levels of pollution is probably getting that from traffic. Yeah, and they say compared with walking in a traffic-free area. Okay, so that's the link. So the study is kind of saying without saying that they're measuring the impact of air pollution that's primarily coming from cars, or vehicles, we should say. Vehicles. Mm-hmm. Listen, I totally get it. My rental car last week when I was traveling was a Chevy something starting with a T that was essentially like a gigantic... Is it Traverse, maybe? Chevy Traverse? It was like it was supposed to be an SUV, but it was like a gigantic minivan, like jacked up kind of a thing. Like, I don't really know. And it got 20 miles per gallon, which is sad because, like, my otherwise, like, 18-year-old Toyota Camry is cranking out, like, over 25 miles per gallon, like, on a regular basis. I guess it's been a couple years since I checked, but so say my Toyota Camry at 16. Anyway, I think what we take away from this is my car is great and SUVs pollute more than we think.
Yeah, I think that's the main takeaway of the study report.
Yeah. You know, the one thing that I'm not sure I love about this is there's a quote where this guy says, like, people like outdoor exercise. We should provide them with spaces to enable that instead of giving them no choice but to walk and cycle through busy, polluted streets.
Right.
So, you
give the people what they want.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, I think we could also look at ways of making the streets less polluted. Like, he's saying we need to build a separate infrastructure where they can go outside to exercise. And as someone who does a lot of bike commuting, I would say, you want to put them on a route with not as much traffic, but is there also a way to encourage people to drive less, to encourage people to use more fuel-efficient vehicles? You know, like, is there a way to make the main traffic thoroughfares less polluted? I mean, it's not just like, well, these are cesspools and there's nothing we can do, right? Like, I'm not sure I agree with that stance.
That's very true. I think that would also definitely help as well.
I just saw a study recently, too, that was talking about bike commuting and safety and kind of like looking at all the factors like the risk of injury. And they found that bike commuting was still better for your health, even when they took into account that you might be breathing in more pollutants. But, yeah, I think that air pollution is something I don't know. I feel like in a way we've kind of given up on it and we've started really focusing in on as like the worried well. On sources of, God help me for using this word, toxins, like organic produce. And it's like, no, if we all like cut down on air conditioner use or if we drove less, like that would actually make a difference, right? I mean,
yeah.
And make a difference for everyone. I think they probably studied people 60 and up with chronic health issues because that's the most sensitive. Like, they're the canary in the coal mine. They're going to get sick first. But
yeah,
there is something scary about pollution. We had a few days over the summer where there was a bunch of fires in Oregon and it was raining ash and it wasn't really safe to exercise outside for a few days. And I can tell you that there is something kind of primordially scary about that, about feeling like your air isn't safe to breathe, like your world is no longer safe for you to exist in. There's something that just, like, gets to some kind of deep biological core fear of existence or existence stopping. You know what I mean? You're just like, God, you look up and the air is just full of smoke. I mean, there's something kind of deeply terrifying about that on some level.
Yeah, but, I mean, living in Ohio, I've never experienced that. But, like, yeah, that would be very nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it's shocking and it's scary to feel like you can't get away from it. I mean, I guess, you know, you could have driven hours, but, you know, there's just something that's very otherworldly about it. So you're, like, our policy wonk here. What did you think about the way that they used politics in this piece? Like, did you agree with the assessment?
I mean, yes, factually, the Trump administration has rolled back regulation, and in part of their stance is that it's those regulations are stifling innovation and growth, and that we need to grow the economy instead of protecting the general environment, that these policies don't do enough to protect the environment to warrant the job-killing regulations.
Okay.
I don't know if... I don't know if the study had that kind of stance, considering that it was, like, a British...
right.
study, which makes me a little bit concerned that they're just connecting it. Also,
yeah,
if you read about it, who sponsors this
study,
these articles,
yeah,
with Huffington Post is there.
Not the study.
This is part of this New World is a series funded by the Partners for New Economy and the Candida Fund.
Oh, whoa, I didn't even see that.
All content is editorially independent, is not influenced or inputted from the foundation. But
yeah,
it definitely has a lean, just looking casually at this is the new world. It definitely is environmentally friendly. So making that connection isn't surprising.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a little bit of, in my opinion, people... you know, speaking to the choir, like the people who are going to read this particular article are probably who have the same views as the author of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I looked up this foundation really quick. It's like candidafund.org. And their vision is, we envision well-being for all within the ecological means of the planet. True sustainability links social and ecological challenges. We seek a world that embeds an understanding of the Earth's planetary boundaries into solutions for more just and equitable societies. So I think it's no surprise that this article made the link that was, like, you know, somewhat surprising to us. But readily made that link, I think, is not something that we shouldn't attribute to the funding. The other thing, since you mentioned funding, I was thinking study funding. And the study itself was funded by a British Heart Foundation grant. So along with some other agencies that I don't know that anyone would have heard of, even if I mentioned them, but some governmental agencies in the UK. But so you can kind of guess that... you know, the Heart Foundation would not take kindly to research that shows no impact on cardiovascular patients from pollution. So, props to the researchers for putting down their interests and acknowledgments. They have also received honoraria for participating in advisory board meetings from pharmaceutical companies who create treatments for asthma and COPD. So I don't know. I don't think that that's, like, a huge concern, but just things to think about, and especially the HuffPost link, I think, is probably the most telling in this case. I don't know that they've shared any incorrect information, but I think, yeah, when they get into U.S. public policy in response to an article or research done in the U.K., kind of like, what happened here? So there you go.
All right. You ready for the next article?
Yeah.
Our next article comes from Time, and it is eating cheese every day may actually be good for you.
Oh my god, my dad sent me the link to this article like 12 hours ago, and I did not read it. I did not read it, and I wrote back, I think this is probably specious at best.
So, it's an article that was like kind of a meta research. It looked at research from China and the Netherlands and combined and analyzed data from 15 observational studies to include more than 200,000 people. All but one of the studies excluded people with existing heart disease, and all but two tracked people for 10 or more years.
Okay.
But it's saying that people who eat 40 grams a day of cheese, which is about the size of a matchbook, had lower risks of heart disease and stroke on average. And that's not saying eating like a ton of cheese is good for you. It's just like a very particular, it's a bell curve. And
there's a sweet spot.
Yeah. They're only able to find association, not causation.
Oh my gosh. See, that's like exactly what I was... That was my response. It's like, we looked up 200,000 people. Yeah, like we found a link.
And it was people self-reporting.
Which I feel like we have talked about so much.
And it doesn't discern against the different types of cheeses.
Okay.
But it's saying that instead of... So there's a growing idea that saturated fats might be more benign than we thought.
In terms of, like, heart disease, right?
Right. So it might be not as bad for us.
Wait.
And it was looking at people who ate cheese versus who rarely or never ate cheese.
I would love to see an actual photograph. I want to see the amount of cheese that the person ate, and I want to see the diary where they recorded how much they ate.
Because I mean, it's just self-reporting.
Right. But...
But it's, that doesn't mean diary entries, Robin. That just means, like I am in a long-term study of,
Wait, what?
Yeah.
What are you in a study for? And how has this not come up?
I'm in a growing up today study. And it's been tracking me for, I think, since I was 8.
Oh, wow. Dude, I can't believe you never told me about this.
And I get, like, a $5 Amazon gift card every time I do it. And they'd send it, like, once a year. And it's just general questions, like, how tall are you? And it's, like, do you feel fat? Do you feel skinny? Do you try to lose weight? And then asking, like... How much of this do you eat? How much of that do you eat? How much drinking do you do? How much smoking do you do? Like, those kinds of things.
I can't believe you... I feel, like, betrayed that you never told me about this. Like, who do you know that would be more interested in you participating in a study than me? Seriously.
Why would this have come up? It's
like I don't know. I mean, listen, some people just send me random studies that they read that they thought were interesting. Because it's me. And I don't
know that anybody's using this data for anything. That would be like my thing that I'd be curious.
Yeah.
What am I a part of?
I mean, yeah, you should try to figure that out. I'm sure that if they've been tracking you for more than 20 years that they're planning on using the data for something, because do you know how time consuming and expensive it is to try to find you and send you something every year? You know what I mean? Because yes. How many times have you moved since you were 8? Like probably half a dozen at least.
Twice.
Twice. No, because college.
Yes, but my parents still stayed where they were, so they still had a way of contacting me. Now they send it via email.
Okay.
And it's a quick bubble test. But back in the day, it was like a huge questionnaire with lots and lots of bubbles.
And you get $5. Well, okay, we will talk more about this later. For now, I would like to let you know that I do not own a matchbook, but I think I know how big a matchbook is, and I feel like that is a very small amount of cheese, right?
Yes, but think about how thinly sliced your cheese is.
Perhaps, but like, okay, think about when we get together and we have pizza. Like, that's like 10 matchbooks worth of cheese, right?
Well, it's shredded cheese, and so you have all the mushrooms.
Oh my gosh, I do have so many mushrooms.
So
world's best pizza topping.
Yes.
Oh my god, I'm so hungry for pizza right now. All right, eyes on the prize. This there is a thing. Okay, quote from this article, this is not the same as eating a big slice of cheesy pizza every day, says Stewart. He doesn't say what happens if I eat an entire thin crust pizza in a sitting, but I'm guessing that that's just furthers his point that that's too much cheese.
Yeah, and they're not saying to go out and make sure that you eat Forty grams a day, but they're just saying you don't have to worry about eating a little bit of cheese.
Eating a little bit. Okay, I think that's true, and obviously saturated fat was demonized in our society for so long, and I believe that that was related to lobbying from the sugar industry. I'm not sure. I that's something I guess I'd be curious to look into. But, you know, when the low-fat food fad hit, do I get points for saying that? Low-fat food fad? When that came about, a lot of foods simply became higher in salt and sugar to make up for the, you know, to make them more flavorful. And so we kind of unfairly demonize fat. So I'm not at all surprised that they're saying, you know, fat is not as bad as we had thought. I would really question people's ability to self-report their cheese intake. I don't know. A bit of cheese on a cracker doesn't sound unreasonable. Like, this just seems a little random to me. Like, I guess I'd like to see a little more data.
What? Robin would like to see more data?
I know. You know, okay, that's fair. And I probably shouldn't make that comment because that's my comment on every single story is like, well, I'd like to see a little more about this. Yes. I love it. Cheese contains potentially beneficial ingredients like calcium, protein, and probiotics. Well, so does, like, fat-free yogurt. I'm not saying. I like the idea of eating some fat, but you know what I found when I was tracking my macronutrients for that month is that I was eating more fat than I had realized just because I was, like, cooking with olive oil, and that kind of, like, added up when I was cooking. You know, if I had, like, two different meals a day that I had cooked, I was like, oh, actually, between, like, peanut butter and olive oil, you know, and if I was eating cheese, like, I often was like, ooh, and we're done with fat for the day, and it would be, like, 2 o'clock. So, I don't know. I mean, I get the point, but I don't know if telling people that eating more fat is okay is good, just from, like, a public health standpoint. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All right.
Ready for article 3?
I mean, yeah, I hope it's not another gigantic study where we find it that, like, sneezing 6 times a week prevents heart attacks or something.
No, it comes from National Public Radio, and it's Tylenol may help ease the pain of hurt feelings.
Okay, this is not news. We've known this for, like, a while, right?
That Tylenol can help...
Yeah!
Emotional pain?
Yes. Yeah, this came out, like, a year or two ago, maybe more. Because it was, like, this really wonky finding, and everyone was talking about it for a while.
I didn't hear about it.
Well, I'm telling you. Yes, okay. April 2015, Tylenol may blunt emotions and not just pain, the New York Times.
No, it's multiple studies.
Oh, so this is the meta-analysis of it.
Mm-hmm. There was All a right. study... published in October suggests that the drug may dampen the tendency to distrust people in the borderline personality disorder.
Oh, cool.
Basically, they discovered that people will will be less offended when if they take Tylenol. It does a little bit of deadening.
So it doesn't fix the problem, it just makes you feel less. So would you feel like if you were excited, would you feel less excited?
Yep.
Or is it just for negative feelings? It's all feelings.
All feelings.
Whoa, another study pointed to reduction in empathy among people taking acetaminophen. Yeah, you know, this is one of those things that came out years ago and that I thought was so exciting. And no one else seemingly thought it was all that exciting. And I thought there was going to be this big, like, swath of research about it. And I guess there seemingly has been, according to this article, talking to us about all the different study findings. But I feel like it's like something that no one paid attention to. It's like there was a thing about heavy metals in protein powder that I thought was going to be this gigantic story, and I was following it and watching it, and then, like, nobody cared. So, I mean, maybe NPR will help people care about this story. I think this is really interesting. Like, I've never heard about anything like this with another drug. Like, the crossover yes. between physical sensation and emotional sensation. Like, I have not... That seems really novel to me.
Yeah. So, do not recommend taking Tylenol on a regular basis because that has also side effects as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're finding out, like, more and more potential negative effects of taking over-the-counter painkillers, including pretty much everything, right? I think there was a big spate of research connecting non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which include ibuprofen, to cardiovascular issues. I haven't looked into that recently, but that, you know, I'd be curious to know more about that. So, yeah. It's one of the...
I just think it's interesting. It's this over-the-counter drug, and, you know, people use it all the time, and it's a name brand and, you know, advertised to us all the time, and there are unintended consequences sometimes. Yeah.
Well, you know what's funny? You know what's funny is that they use Tylenol in the headline because that's a brand name, right? Like,
yes.
If this was a study about aspirin and it said Bayer may decrease the risk of strokes or whatever, you'd be like, why they use Bayer and not aspirin? But they must think that we don't know the word acetaminophen because they use Tylenol.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair, though.
Yeah, no, that is fair.
The common person.
I think that there's actually been a movement in, like, medical school curricula to try to get people who are teaching and learning about medicine to use the generic names as opposed to the brand names for obvious reasons. You don't want a bunch of people who are, like, you know, if multiple companies make the same drug, you don't want it to be like, oh, we always use the Novartis. Or just, you don't want to be kind of, like, inculcating people with loyalties to various pharmaceutical companies. It's kind of a curious process.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was the whole thing, this article mentions at the very end, there was the whole thing about accidental acetaminophen overdoses because it tends to be in like cold remedies and things. So people would take like some kind of cough syrup, cold medicine in liquid form, and then also take acetaminophen. See, I almost just said Tylenol. And also take the pill form and then not realize that they'd accidentally OD'd. I mean, I don't know. When does it become an overdose versus just like you took more than you were supposed to?
I'm not sure. What is that level?
I know there's a thing called like an LD50, which is like a lethal dose for 50% of the population, but that's a little different. Well, Wikipedia says it's just ingestion in quantities greater than are recommended or generally practiced. So technically, if you take more than it says on the label, you've overdosed. I think colloquially, we think of overdose like heroin, right? Because I think overdose death, right? In my brain, there's like a link.
Mm-hmm.
This is cool. Well, I'm glad that someone brought this back up.
Yeah, I think that it looks really good.
You know what I really miss? And this is directed at the manufacturers of Tylenol. There used to be a grape chewable children's Tylenol that was delicious. And I miss it. Okay? They don't have it anymore. And I don't understand why not. There was cherry and there was grape. But the grape flavor was the good flavor. And I have wanted grape chewable Tylenol for many years. So I don't know who makes Tylenol. But if you're out there, bring back the grape chewables. Do you remember those?
Yes, they tasted terrible.
What? No, they were awful. So delicious. So delicious. Okay, it's McNeil Consumer Healthcare. So We should, Laura, we should tweet them and ask them what happened to grape chewable Tylenol.
No, it was the worst.
Listen, what do they have now? They have like the baby ones that are like bubblegum flavored. Nobody wants that. I'm gonna Google this right now.
No, the grape flavor made me shudder.
Wait, it's on Amazon. No, it's not the same. They're like meltaways. I don't even know what that means. No.
It means that you can't choke on it. That's what that means.
Oh, is that what that means?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
It means it dissolves.
Hey. They have a grape-flavored chewable and a meltaway. Oh, the meltaway is a different brand. Oh, my God. Do you think it's the same?
Maybe.
Sweet. All right. Meltaways. Well, my day's good now. How about you?
No.
I don't even need Tylenol. I just, you know.
You're going to eat like 24 Meltaways in order to get like the right dosage or something.
I know. It probably is. God, I don't know. I haven't taken Tylenol in years. It doesn't really work for me. But I'm going to start, because now if I'm having negative emotions and I just want to have a happy reminder of childhood, it's a twofer.
Two for one.
Sweet. All right, next story.
Our last story comes from runnersworld.com, and it's 4 ways to master your running form. Sweet. So last week you were talking about how to improve your running form, and I thought, what the hell is she talking about? Apparently other people have thought that too.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm glad you looked this up. I've been working on this all week.
So there are 4 different ways. They do not recommend that you change your natural running rhythm, because that can lead to injury.
Too late.
But there are proper form cues, which are universally accepted by among coaches, scientists, and sports medicine professionals.
Okay.
There is running tall, which is simply means being upright and balanced as possible. It starts with the hips. Pull your butt in, rotate your hips back, straighten your spine, and lift your chest. Your shoulders should be pulled back and down. Your head should be stacked directly over the straight spine and neck. Imagine a string attached to your head, lifting you upward and gently pulling you forward at the same time. I feel like this is an etiquette class for like women.
This is secretly from like a Dear Prudence column. Like, how can I look appropriate at my debutante ball? Well, pull your shoulders back and down. I think
run tall.
Yeah. No, this one is really good. And I think some of this stuff might be hard for people to do. Like, it says rotate your hips back. I don't know how many runners can translate that command into an actual physical movement. But the one tip I got that has been helpful to me is this idea of, like, pulling your neck up. So just, like what it says here, like, the whole, like, string attached to your head. And supposedly, if you are able to, like, lengthen your neck, that will, like, translate to other positive changes, like, all the way down the kinetic chain or whatever. So, yeah. Okay, I'm thumbs up on that one. I'm working on it.
And then keep your elbows back. That is, the cue is that runners should touch their waistband with each stride to ensure that their arm drives back and opens up behind the body.
Okay. Yeah, I know that there's something about, like, your ideal arm movement, I've heard, is that, like, it's like elbow at your waist to like fingertips at your waist, and if you're doing more or less than that, like, it's either too much or too little.
Yes.
And you don't want to cross over too much. I struggle with this one though. I really don't know if I'm doing it well or not.
If your arms only stay in front of your body, they tend to swing across your midsection, misdirecting motion and wasting energy in sideways and rotational movements.
Yep. Okay.
There's also run soft and quiet. And that is to be able to reduce their foot impact. It means less stress on bones, joints, and muscles.
Okay, this one, Like, yes, but, like, if at the beginning they said not to change your... Did they say not to change your cadence at the beginning?
Not to try to do something that's not...
It's not natural. I can't find that part.
Think about running on ice. Yeah. That's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, because this kind of is... I think that this should be, from what I've read, should be the outcome of increasing your cadence. Because it's like, if you want to have less force with each step, you have to take more steps per minute so that your foot is not on the ground for as long. So part of it is how your foot lands, and part of it is how quickly, like how quick your turnover is. So, yeah, I mean, yes to this one. It's curious that they say people who are told to run softly can do it. I have found that what works for me when I'm trying to like fix this specific thing, because you know I've tried, is running on like a softer surface, like trail running when it's a little bit rocky and you're like picking your feet up quickly to avoid like stepping hard on a rock, or like even running if you run on like along the side of a trail where there are some leaves in the fall. I just did this last week when I was in Ohio to kind of try to get myself to run a little lighter, because it's like with the leaf cover you can't quite see where your foot's going, and so you tend to run a little more quietly. So yeah, I like this one too.
And the last one is do 10-second striders. When you're starting to feel tired, it's not the time to slow down. Distance runners need to think that they think they need to do slowing down is better for them, but actually doing a 10-second speed up every 5 to 7 minutes once fatigue begins to set in. It's not sprinting, it's just picking up your cadence and speed slightly, and it changes the muscle groups that you call on and can make running feel easier and more natural.
Oh, okay. I haven't heard of this one, but I'm going to try it. One thing I've learned, or I've been told by all sorts of people, is that a lot of people tend to have better running form when they're running at faster speeds. So if you think about like sprinting versus like marathon pace. And there's something like where you kind of click in. And so people kind of sometimes struggle with form when they slow down too much, because it's like you kind of can't keep everything coordinated together. And you tend to, like, you're supposed to kind of pick your heel up a certain amount. And people, when they slow down, kind of tend to lengthen out their stride in a way that's not good. So, yeah, I like this because it is kind of difficult. If the idea is don't slow down too much and you get to the point in a run when you're really tired, then, yeah, how do you, like, keep it going without forcing yourself into a pace that's like too fast.
Yeah. So I thought, here are some ways to help you.
Yeah. You know, there's even like, there's a bike exercise that's similar where you, like, if you're getting tired and you're having trouble like keeping up the speed or keeping up your motivation to keep going, you try to focus on like one foot of like pushing forward hard or like turning the pedals with one foot for like 30 seconds. Hard, and then 30 seconds on the other side to kind of like, and then hopefully you forget about it and you just keep going. So yeah, okay, this one I haven't tried and I'll definitely try. I like it.
Okay.
Man, all right. I guess we can see what I'm enthusiastic about. Laura, are you going to use these to like, are you going to use these to fix your running form, improve your running form?
I have like the most perfect running form.
Your running form is like an untouched Picasso, right? It's just, it's pristine. It's never been messed with.
Yeah, it's important not to mess with perfection.
Well, you know, they say that like little kids naturally have good running form. Like there's something in chi running where they say like, it's so infuriating. It's like, watch a small child run. They're not thinking about it at all. And yet they're doing everything perfectly. You just have to run free and loose like a child. And you're thinking, oh my God, I'm trying so hard and I'm still screwing it up. Do not tell me to run like a 3-year-old. But so maybe if you've never been a runner, then maybe Laura, if we were to like put you on a treadmill, you would just like your body would just remember only running in childhood and you would just naturally have perfect form. I mean, that's possible.
I mean, it's possible. It's not very probable.
There's only one way to find out.
I guess we're going to have to live with the mystery.
All right.
So what's your current medical fascination?
Okay, well, this week I'm totally focused on heart rate tracking, which, I mean, I should have asked you what my medical fascination was, because I think I've been texting you about this all week, right? Maybe?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I've been texting you about how ugly my watch is, and because, spoilers, like, in order to get a heart rate monitor into a watch and not require a chest strap, the watch has to be somewhat large, or, if not somewhat large, extremely expensive. So I chose the slightly large option, hoping that it would work, and instead, it looks like what I believe your husband has described as a dinner plate on my hand. But anyway, to make a long story short, one, I would love to see a little more emphasis on sporting equipment designed for women, and I do not mean like smaller and pinker. I mean stuff that actually works. You know, I don't want pink. I want something that works and that like is designed for me, not like a dude. So anyway, so I've got this thing and I'm wearing it all the time because it's me and I'm wearing it all the time, and it's like tracking my sleep, which is amazing and so fun to look at, and I've already started questioning the accuracy, so don't worry. But what I'm really interested in is how to use the heart rate during my workouts to kind of like maximize my efforts. So I really haven't done much looking into it. My PT kind of mentioned to me that like heart rate tracking could be good. And so after like 2.5 years of training more or less blind in terms of like this metric, or I mean, I've got an app on my phone that tracks speed and distance. But for swimming, I've had nothing at all. I just get a time and a distance, and that's all I know. So this idea that I could use my heart rate to track how much work I'm actually doing, like how quickly I might be recovering or not, that I could look at my resting heart rate to see if it's time for me to take a break. I mean, heart rate's not everything, but it feels like everything to me right now because I've never had any of this information. So just this kind of like exploration of how this might inform my training and hopefully make me you know, less likely to get injuries is just wildly, wildly exciting. And I'm just, I'm having like such a good time with it, even though I don't like the appearance of the watch in question, like having a really good time with the data. So,
yeah. Yay.
I know. I hate to like encourage people to like be materialistic and like buy more things, but you know, a couple years into the journey, I'm hoping that it will kind of change my triathlon training for the better. So, Laura, I think that's enough bad patienting for me for 1 week. But before we let everyone go, we have so many things to remind them about, right?
Yeah.
So first of all, you guys, thanks for listening. We're seeing more listens as the weeks go on. It's just been really humbling and cool to see old friends and new friends and people we don't even know listening to the podcast. So we hope that if we can improve anything, if you would like to share feedback, that you'll email us at hello@thebadpatient.com, that you will share our URL, thebadpatient.com, with friends who might like to listen as well. You can tweet us at @thebadpatient, and you can rate, share, and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, the iPhone podcast app, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. And the only other thing is we want to thank our composer, Evan Schaefer.
Thanks, Evan.
And you can listen to Evan's music at soundcloud.com/Evan Schaefer. Until next time, we are Bad Patient.
Malpractice makes perfect.